Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is the Healthy Mind Radio Show. Here, we talk about our emotional health and well-being, about living the most authentic life we possibly can, the one we truly deserve. So take notice, our true strength and action are on the march, while our fears and self-doubt are on the run. Never doubt how truly powerful you are. Let's learn together, right here on The Healthy Mind. All right, well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is The Healthy Mind Podcast for February 20th, 2013. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program today. I really do appreciate it. I have a great program for you today. We're going to be talking about ADHD today. Do you think you got it? Focus, concentration, not being able to focus on anything? Well, for the entirety of the podcast, we have truly an international authority on ADHD, Dr. Tim Bilkey, author of the new book, Fast Minds, How to Thrive If You Have ADHD or Think You Might. And it's a really great book, a very easy read. I've started recommending it to my patients. It really is a wonderful book if you're struggling with ADHD or you think you might have it. But even if you are a loved one of someone who's struggling with ADD, there's some really practical advice in understanding how the ADHD mind, the fast mind, works. So for the bulk of the program, the entire program, my interview with Dr. Tim Bilkey, author of Fast Minds. The website, as always, www.thehealthymind.com. Any questions or comments that you have, please don't hesitate to email me. Thank you so much for the emails and your patience in me getting back to you. I know I've been a little slow in getting back to you, but I will answer every one of those emails. Peter@thehealthymind.com. So, are you ready? Let's begin. Okay, as I had said earlier here in the podcast, I am so privileged to have Dr. Tim Bilkey with me today. Dr. Bilkey is truly an international authority on attention deficit disorder and co-author of the book Fast Minds, How to Thrive If You Have ADHD or Think You Might. And we're going to get more into the book here very shortly. But a little bit about Dr. Bilkey, and I'm going to have him talk about himself as well. I don't want to dominate the discussion, but he's an adult psychiatrist. He's a psychiatrist in Canada, and his expertise in ADHD has been amazing over his career. He's treated over 3,400 adolescents in his entire career. But in addition to his clinical career, he is truly an educator. He has lectured on the impact of attention deficit disorder throughout the human lifespan. But Fast Minds isn't just a book that he's written, actually something quite larger. You see, Dr. Bilkey has had this Fast Minds program accredited for those professionals and physicians who want further training on ADHD. As I had told him just before coming on the program, this is a book that I have read. It speaks a lot to me because I see quite a bit of ADHD in my practice, and it brings up and answers a lot of questions, particularly for adults when they come and want to know more about ADD. But there's a lot that I could say more about Dr. Bilkey, but I don't want to dominate the conversation, so I will just say welcome and thank you so much, Dr. Bilkey, for joining me here on The Healthy Mind.
It's a great pleasure, Peter. Thank you for having me.
No, the pleasure is truly mine. And again, I thank you for being on the podcast. I guess I just want to start out from the beginning, maybe to get a sense from you on how your interest started in ADHD and how it has evolved to this point. Tell us a little bit about who you are and your mission in ADHD.
Well, yes, thank you. I started in 1996. I had a couple of patients that I saw. And in those days, prescribing medication for adult ADHD, that wasn't very common. I had a taxi driver who said he'd been diagnosed as a child and he'd had several accidents in his professional area. So I started him on a medicine that he'd had as a child. And he really improved significantly. He was much more proficient driver. And then he told me, you know, I have this small son and, you know, I think he has ADHD, and it sort of resonated with me in terms of the genetics of the condition. So over time, I just inherited a number of people and built up a specialty interest in this area.
Well, and not just a clinical interest, but you went on to develop a formal accreditation program for professionals who are interested in going further in their understanding and treatment of attention deficit disorder with the Fast Minds program. Can you tell us a little bit about the evolution of that? How did that accredited program come into being?
Right. Well, one of my main mandates is education around adult ADHD. And I recognized when I spoke with colleagues, you know, if you say attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, it's kind of a black box in terms of what it really is. I mean, they do have an attention span. They're not hyperactive, bouncing off walls. So I developed an educational program through the original Fast Minds acronym that doctors could quickly recognize as ADHD. We love acronyms,
yes,
as physicians. dig fast, Siggy caps, all that. So
that's
I came
right.
up with the original Fast Minds.
And to review with everyone what that stands for, the acronym FAST MINDS, and it's F, forgetful, A, achieving below potential, S, stuck in a rut, T, time challenged, M, motivationally challenged, I, impulsive, N, novelty seeking, D, distractible, and S, scattered. So a very quick and easy way to understand kind of the main characteristics of someone with ADHD, Fast Minds. And I'm sure that a lot of people who are listening to the podcast and that I see in my clinical practice, adults, my practice focuses on adults, and we see this presentation with people quite a bit. And I guess the one part that I really want to at least start out with you is that perhaps in the adult community, how is it that an adult individual can get through life fairly well, but they really do still have problems with attention and focus? They're still struggling with symptoms of ADD, but they end up coming in for treatment later in life as an adult, maybe beyond schooling. What do you think makes the difference in these individuals? I guess, how should they know when they would get treatment?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that many adults with ADHD get by. They have good abilities, good skill sets. But one of the issues is this sort of unrequited feeling of not firing on all cylinders.
Yes.
So they do okay, but not reaching their full potential. And they're often told by other people, parents, educators, you know, we know you're a really smart guy. We know you can do better. You just need to sort of pull up your socks. So they put a ton of effort into how they function. It's called compensatory burden. So it's the amount of energy and effort that somebody has to put into their lives to make their life look like it's fine. The analogy I often use is the swan going across the river. It's a very serene looking bird, but underneath the water, these feet are churning away, which creates this illusion that everything's serene and easy. So it's the amount of effort that people have to pump into their lives. And then across the timeline, we see people presenting because they'll get stuck academically at a higher level, maybe, or they'll be in the workplace passed over for promotion because of distractibility, disorganization. So it's still this issue of not quite reaching their potential, which is important.
Yeah, I really got to tell you, that description of the swan is really such a beautiful way of understanding it. It creates a really nice visual of what someone with ADD is going through. I know in my sessions when I'm talking to individuals about it, I try to liken it to you're just trying to paddle as hard as you can just to keep your head above water. Now, with that in mind, why do you think that there's still so much of a struggle, at least in the lay population, those that go in to possibly get treated for ADD, why do you think it's so hard for people to accept the fact that this is, I guess for lack of a better word, a real disorder? Why is it that they're finding it so hard to accept that? How much of this do you feel is genetics with regards to ADD versus maybe a product of the culture? And I ask you all of this because I want my listeners to know, but kind of selfishly, I'd like to get your thoughts so that I'm properly relaying the information to my patients. And I'm really a fan of evolutionary psychology, so I love how in your book you talk about the evolutionary advantages for early man to possibly have these traits that are specific for ADD. I'm really interested in your thoughts of how much of ADD is biological versus how much of it may be due to the culture that we have, the society that perhaps causes us to be more distracted.
Yes. Well, it's a great point. Sure. And I think the adaptive, creative side of being able to focus when there's a lot of adrenaline and risk-taking, an adventuresome sort of nature and so forth, I think that's all very positive. I feel, though, that in a modern culture, there are so many multiple demands being made of us, all these balls that we have to juggle. So I feel that people... contextually, they may function well in an emergency department if it's a physician, or the courtroom if it's a lawyer. But ADD impacts on people in multiple domains. So you could function very well in one area and have lots of trouble on the home front, doing bills, doing taxes, all of that sort of thing. And there's much more of that now and less need for people having an adventuresome life, perhaps.
Yes, I understand. It's just a different set of circumstances which really poses its own kind of stress. Your thoughts, and I've always thought about it, it's kind of been my own speculation in thinking about ADD, at least for, gosh, and I'm going to consider myself a young person being in my mid-40s, but in my generation, where it really, the 24-hour news cycle, TV on all the time, and gosh, of course, the internet over the last 20 years, the fact that there's so much information coming at us, how much of that, in your opinion, in your experience, has been a part of it, and that the brain itself is adapting to different ways of attending to so many stimuli that are out there?
Well, I think that's an interesting feature of a modern life, so many stimulating activities. And actually, people with ADHD can adapt in those kinds of environments very well. For example, being a city TV producer, you know, you could function very well with lots of action and stimulation. I think people with ADHD, however, can be overwhelmed by it. And with the internet, there's so many interesting things. The computer is a constant source of novelty, tactile, auditory, visual stimulation. So people can actually spend inordinate amounts of time being absorbed. I call it the Vulcan mind meld, where they spend so much time being absorbed by that activity. And in the new DSM, there will be issues around internet addiction, and I think people are prone to that with ADHD.
Yes.
People will often talk about hyper-focus. I get hyper-focused when I'm on the computer, stumble upon the Wikipedia loop. I just I don't notice too many adults with ADHD getting hyper-focused on their political science homework or their taxes. So I think it's
great
sort
point.
Of there are few issues at play.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Coming back a bit to the Fast Mind, both the program and also the book, I want to cover the book, but I wanted to come back to the program. How was it that you had decided you were going to first off develop this, the Fast Minds program, to the point where it got accredited? How did that go from idea to the point where you had gotten it to where it's at today, and also, of course, the book that you've written.
Right. Well, I looked at the DSM way of diagnosing ADHD, 5 criteria, symptom cutoffs. And when I spoke with other physicians, it was very skeletal in terms of they're forgetful, they underachieve, and so forth. And as you know, as physicians, we learn through history taking certain profiles or certain red flag symptoms, pictures of patient presentation where we, oh, this sounds more like hypothyroidism or I'm suspecting pneumonia and so forth. So what I did is I developed 10 stories or clinical profiles of what ADHD really looked like. And then I developed a video program so I would actually demonstrate with using actors the struggling student, married with children profile, a person who was very stuck, and these different pictures. Physicians would, it resonated with them. They would walk up to me later and say, you know, you just reminded me of a couple of people that may have ADHD. And that's how that program, so we tied the acronym together with clinical stories about how ADHD would present. That's how it really began.
I see. Now, how did that take off? Was that just through momentum? People were hearing about it and getting more excited about it. How did it get from where you had put it together to where it actually now is an accredited program?
So we ran a pilot program. We went to family physicians centers and showed them the program and asked them to critique it. Was it valuable to them? Did it meet stated objectives that you'd be more aware of when to suspect underlying adult ADHD? And that went quite well. And so we went for national accreditation. So we had to have family physicians across Canada to critique it, review it. And through that process, since 2009, actually, we've had national accreditation. So doctors, and it's totally a clinical program, so doctors walk away with a much better sense of when to ask questions around ADHD or to suspect its presence.
Wow, that is just wonderful. Now, I'm just wondering, has there been any traction here in the States? Has there been any part of that in the program that has been able to be adapted at all here with regards to ADD?
Not in the exact sense that I've described it, but for physicians to learn, Anders Ericsson gave a plenary lecture on how physicians learn, and he talked about this kind of real-time clinical demonstration of interviewing techniques, listening to patients, and I think that kind of program is going to get greater traction because that's, as you know, as a physician, that's how we learn, our history-taking.
Yes, it's very true. And making sure that we are listening and the subtleties and not so subtleties of the doctor-patient relationship, how much the stressors of today's medical world that has nothing to do with the patients really maybe infiltrating and compromising patient care. We're rushed. We have to get prior authorization for sessions and medications. It really can be a challenge. Why do you think that there's so much resistance? And I acknowledge it's getting better, but why do you think, specifically within the medical community, that there still is this resistance, if you will, to treating ADD? I mean, is it simply regulatory concerns in terms of the fact that you have to prescribe things like stimulants? What is your sense as to why that resistance is there?
I think adult ADHD goes under-recognized because the symptoms are lifelong. So most psychiatrists would see a patient for a half an hour, an hour. It's hard to cover that person's lifeline. And these people have had these symptoms always. And by the time an adult sees a specialist or a family doctor, much of the significant hyperactivity has gone away. So you're dealing with these very subtle cognitive symptoms. And I think it's too easy to judge people, perhaps, as being just unmotivated, kind of lazy. So you just need to write it down, make a list, and so forth.
Yes.
If it were that easy, they would have done that, and things would be fine. And I think the other issue is that in psychiatric subspecialties, People will say, well, we recognize bipolar. I don't know about this ADHD business. I think ADHD now is where, at least in Canada, where bipolar was 15 years ago, where we were treating a lot of depression and not picking up on bipolarity. So I think we're moving in the general direction of better recognition. In Canada, there are a number of mood disorder experts who are picking up the ball and really scanning for ADHD as a comorbidity. So we're getting much better at that now.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I think it's in no small part due to the advocacy and teaching that you've done on your own. So I'm sure it's very rewarding on your part to see that happening and being a part of it, and in also in moving forward and at least getting recognition and proper treatment for our patients in ADD. You know, I would agree with you. There's so many symptoms with ADD that overlap with depression. And I know for me, personally speaking, it's not always easy to just definitely be able to tell which part of this is ADD versus depression. And quite frankly, and in those times when it isn't completely 100% sure, you almost have to do the treatment to see what happens, see that improvement to help make the diagnosis of ADD. Because sometimes it's not as easy as someone coming in and just saying, you know, I think I have ADD, and here are the textbook symptoms for that. I'm sure you've experienced it, cases where it's treatment-resistant depression or other types of presentations where it makes you think, gosh, could this be ADD or some other type of diagnosis?
Yeah, that's exactly true. And that's one of our 10 profiles. We call it the comorbid presentation, where someone's been treated for an anxiety or mood disorder and either got better because that was the right diagnosis, or they're treated as refractory cases and it's the underlying ADHD that's been at play along the way.
I see. Now, going back to the book, Fast Minds, I wanted to just understand from you in terms of what was the motivation for writing the book. I mean, I would imagine maybe it came because of the success of the Fast Minds program, but can you tell us what was the motivation for the two of you to put this into a book that became Fast Minds?
Okay, well, it's a great question. I find that a lot of doctors want to write books. And so I was sitting around in my study and thinking, well, you know, we've done these programs. Why don't we try to write about it? And I wasn't sure that I really had a voice as a writer, but I had a go at it, and I had a number of chapters. And then I attended a workshop at Harvard, Harvard Health Publications. Julie Silver runs that program. Uh-huh. And they teach you about how to write, and then they give you this 70-second pitch. So you can get up in front of hundreds of other wannabe writers, physicians, and pitch your deal. So I did that, and we got pretty good feedback from that. And then I collaborated with Craig. So it's not the book that I initially was working on. It's a different book, and I think it's been a very enriching experience because it's a team effort. It's a collaborative kind of creative process. We have a writer, so putting our heads together with these meetings and coming up with ideas. It was really fascinating, and to write a book, you really, as you know, you have to get your own ideas fixed about how you understand a condition and so forth.
Yes.
And so it was an interesting crystallization of ADHD science and clinical stories.
Yeah, I think it's woven beautifully. Clearly, we're talking about the book Fast Minds, How to Thrive If You Have ADHD or You Think You Might. And Craig, as Dr. Bilkey referred to, is Dr. Craig Surman, who is the co-author of the book of Fast Minds. And I'm very happy to say that in a few weeks, I will have Dr. Surman on as well, because it really is an important area of psychiatry and where it overlaps. And it just doesn't seem like there's been enough recognition and a ton of stereotype and stigma. Additionally, the types of medications that are used to treat this particular condition also adds to the resistance or the hesitancy to treat. all of this gets in the way of getting proper treatment. So a book like Fast Minds is an important book. Now, in addition to it being on the show notes, you can just go to the show notes of this podcast and there will be a link to the book. I'll also have this, though, on my permanent links page at thehealthymind.com as well. Now, there is a decent awareness of the treatment of ADD, at least from the medication perspective. The traditional ones being Strattera and the stimulants themselves, but I wanted to get from you, at least from what you've written in the book, some of the non-medication treatments for ADD and really just what people can anticipate when they read Fast Minds.
Sure. We wrote the book so that people can recognize whether they have the Fast Minds traits, but also importantly, it's for someone who's in a relationship with someone who may have ADHD. So we ask two sets of questions. Do you do this or do people say that you do this? And along the way, then it builds momentum in terms of people self-selecting which traits they may have. And when we get to the treatment section, people can self-select for the treatments that make the most sense for them. So by the time they're finished the book, they have an individualized version of ADHD and the things that work the best. And in the non-drug category, what else works? We talk about evidence-based cognitive behavioral therapy. Often people have negative automatic thoughts, and we delve into CBT and help them understand better what that's about. We talk about mindfulness and the evidence for that with ADHD. We have a section on habits and people knowing when they're more engaged, when they're functioning on all cylinders, and when to recognize that. So we talk about these critical moments. And then how to develop better habits. So we talk about sleep and exercise and food like medicine. So a lot of ADHD people are night owls. We help them understand they need to get to bed at a certain time, get up a certain time, eat meals, exercise. So there are a whole host of non-drug things we talk about. And we also, Craig was really good at this. He built a section in where we help people look at the literature a little bit and critique the effectiveness of a particular treatment that they may be reading about so that they can become their own scientist in a way.
That was wonderful.
To study. Yeah, that was a great piece. That was Craig's work. And I thought that was wonderful to help people, you know, learn more about it and advocate for themselves.
Yeah, it really is. It was a beautiful section. And really, the entire book is a lovely approach to it. And I really agree with you. Those who suffer with ADD, but unlike some of the other books that are out there, from the perspective of the loved one or someone who cares for that individual, it's almost like ADD Anon, if you will, for the individual. Because there are two sides to this. Families that suffer, couples that suffer. There are consequences in the treatment of the ADD and in the therapy that we do is to pick up some of the damage, some of the pieces that some of that behavior causes and how that could be misconstrued by family members and loved ones being aloof or non-caring or selfish or narcissistic. So it's really nice that this book appeals to both ends of the spectrum here. Now, in terms of the stimulants, and I know that it is a big issue, it's controversial, and people worry about it. Even those that are coming in to get treatment from me or have gotten testing, the biggest concerns are, what are the long-term issues? How long do I have to be on these meds? Am I going to be on this forever? Is this eventually going to burn out? What have you found is the best way to reassure individuals and perhaps some of the data that you have on the long-term implications? What are some of the reasonable expectations for how long people have to be on the medication? I mean, 50s, 60s, beyond?
Yeah, these are great questions. In the book, we talk about, in the last chapter, dreaming big. And it's short-term, mid-term, and long-term goals. And that came from this notion of, you have ADHD, we'll talk about treatments, but what's your 3 to 5 year plan? Mm-hmm. We'll treat it, but where are you going to be in 3 to 5 years? And I think because prospective planning is a challenge with ADHD, we get people to look at that. And I'm very invested in the idea that people work at a job which focuses on their aptitudinal gifts and strengths. So with that as a context, then we talk about short-term goals, distractibility, forgetfulness, and it's very important to give informed consent. So we have 5 Health Canada approved medicines, and we spend a lot of time helping people understand what the side effects are, and in our book we also address that.
Okay.
And then we talk about the science, because really these medicines are some of the most effective medications that we have. After a few months of treatment, it may be advisable for people to stop taking the stimulant medicines, for using as an example, and to revisit at baseline what the drugs were actually doing, what the medicines were helping with.
Okay.
The majority of adults that I see don't come banging on the door saying, you know, I have ADD and I want some kind of stimulant medicine. What they will often say is, I don't know if I have it, but if I do have it, I want some treatment because I've dropped out of university, I'm working on my second marriage, I get passed over for promotion. So they have been impacted severely. They have poor driving records as well. And a careful evaluation for ADHD and careful slow titration of medication, so not going to quite high doses, measuring symptom remission, I think these things guard against over-prescription of stimulant medicines.
I see.
The majority of adults I see do not abuse medicines because these are the very drugs that are helping them achieve a balanced life. It doesn't make any sense that they would start to abuse that drug.
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that's been my experience as well. People stay on the medications because it helps them, but they don't abuse them. I mean, I can't even recall the last time anyone took an inappropriate amount of these medications that are being treated for ADD, with the possible exception of maybe they didn't feel the current dose was working well enough, so they might have taken an extra pill. But outside of that, I just don't see it being a problem. And I'd have to say it's the same type of phenomenon in those individuals as well. People who need it for pain do not abuse the medications, unless, of course, there's a history of substance abuse or a family history of substance abuse. But if you could indulge me, I want to go back to something that you just said, a period of time where you have the individual come off of the stimulant or the medication to see how they're doing. Could you elaborate a little bit on that in terms of what its purpose is and what type of success perhaps you have in people not needing to go back on the medication after coming off of the medication?
It helps people. So you have FastMind's traits at baseline. And then we discuss target symptoms with people. Okay, you want to fix procrastination, time management, forgetfulness, distractibility, and so forth. And in the book, we have a FastMind's trait tracker, so people can actually look at how we dose and how well that particular dose helps those particular traits. But I think it's a little bit like, having Ventolin for asthma, maybe. Maybe you don't need it all the time, and let's revisit what these medicines are really doing. And I think it's very helpful for the physician, but also the person with ADHD. I see this treatment very much as a collaborative process. And at least in Canada, we're encouraging family doctors to take this up because they know these people very well. But the tapering off and visiting what the drug does, I think that's a very helpful thing to validate the condition, but also what we're doing in order to help our patients.
Is there a sense on your part, as you've done this now very consistently, do you find that most individuals will eventually resume the medications again? Or do you find that for some individuals, they're able to stop the medication after that short period of time and they've done fairly well and don't have to be on the medication? What's been your experience with that particular approach?
Some people may choose to say, you know what, I've learned enough of the non-drug strategies, not being so negative, I'm not beating myself up, my wife sort of likes me better now, and so forth, that she's not so mad at me, that I may not need it. I think for university students, as a good example, to get through school, That's a useful time to have the medicine, and maybe you don't need it after that. And I think everybody, in the book we talk about different versions of ADHD, because I don't think there's just three or four little subtypes. We don't. Mm-hmm. And so I think everybody's a bit different with that one. It's sort of like saying asthma or diabetes. These are all, everybody's basically the same. I don't think that's true. So I think for the clinician, it's important to keep an open mind about people maybe not needing the medicine long-term and individualized. And their care for people.
And I think that's very hopeful as well, not only for the individual patient who might have a concern about being on stimulant medications, although I think that's changing some of the data that you've even provided in the book, really understanding that in ADD, there's an under-metabolism in the brain, not an over-metabolism, and the stimulants bring the brain to functioning at a normal level so that the brain can focus. But I think it's very hopeful for clinicians to hear this as well, because you may not be feeling that just because you treat someone for ADD that you have to treat them for the rest of their lives. But is there a sense from you, since you have spoken on ADD for all this time, along the lifespan, you know, principally to patients, because that's who is typically listening to the program, but even to clinicians who are listening, what is your experience on individuals who are being treated for ADD that have, through using some of the non-medication interventions, the mindfulness you talk about, the CBT, to be able to successfully come off of the medications, whether it's 3 years or 5 years or whatever, is it something that individuals can look forward to as part of their treatment?
Yes, I think that's a very good point. Cognitive behavioral therapy, as an example, CBT for adolescents who have ADHD, in teens that participated in these programs, there was lower doses of medication necessary. There was better treatment adherence. So I think the truth is in the middle. I think that combining medication with the various interventions that we describe in the book, I think that's a vital part of this. Simply giving a medication and hoping that all of the issues around ADHD will fix up, I think, is oversimplification.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, nowhere else in medicine is this the case. I mean, no one really tells a diabetic when they're treating them, well, here's your insulin, and hey, no problem. Go ahead and eat all the cheesecakes you want now. So that's just not going to happen. So clearly that is true. Gosh, I could really continue speaking to you probably for hours here on this particular subject, and I really appreciate the time that you've taken. I know you've taken time out of your clinical day to speak with me, so I have just one final question, if I may, here. With regards to the individual who's listening to this and is saying, well, you know, maybe I do have ADD, maybe I do need to get help, but they're worried about the stigma or the stereotype or being perceived as maybe drug-seeking. What do you feel is the best way for an individual who might feel that they have ADD to go in and talk to their doctor about it and possibly getting treatment?
It's a great question. We encourage people to get online, check some of the screens, you know, familiar yourself with the ADHD symptoms, and then go to your family doctor. I saw a woman today who was 22, and she learned about ADD, and she simply went to her family doctor and said, you know, I may have these symptoms. My uncle was diagnosed. And since that family doctor had a good appreciation of her life, he was able to say, look, let's do a screening. Mm-hmm. If you bump into a physician, though, who says, I don't know anything about it, you know, whatever, I think you need to advocate, ask to be sent to a specialist if that's required, and keep advocating in that way until you get the answers, whether you do or you don't. And the other issue that's important is, I don't make this borderline diagnosis. I think you do have a condition or not, and so get that answer and move forward for that, and not to stop until you get those answers.
Wow, yes, some great, great points that you make. Ladies and gentlemen, it just, and I say it a lot, you have to be responsible for your care. I'm not saying don't listen to your doctors or be disrespectful to them if you disagree with them, but really make sure you understand your condition. And if you don't feel that you're being heard or need a different voice or a different opinion, get it. It is your health care, and it is very, very important. And you need to advocate for yourself. It is wonderful, at least as it relates to conditions like ADD. Books like this, experts like Dr. Bilkey and Dr. Sermon, really raising the awareness. And through books like Fast Minds, people can read it and really understand that they aren't alone. And that really can motivate people to really seek out the care that they need. Dr. Bilkey, I can't thank you enough. Again, the book, Fast Minds, How to Thrive If You Have ADHD or Think You Might. Dr. Bilkey is with us today and is co-author with Dr. Craig Sermon. I hope you'll agree to it. I hope this isn't the last time that we talk. I would love to have you on again at a later time. Perhaps we can pick up the discussion again if you'll agree to it.
Anytime. Just call me.
Well, wonderful. That's great. I'll look forward to it. Thank you again. It really was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for having me, Peter. All the best.
And there he goes, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Tim Bilkey, author, co-author of the book Fast Minds. What an amazing individual. What he is doing, what he's really done over his career thus far to really advocate for ADHD and really bring that to people so that they understand what it is, and in at least in the form of the accredited program that they've done, the Fast Minds program, they're helping clinicians understand it more. Wow, just a great, great interview, and I can't thank him enough, and I'm really excited to hear from Dr. Sermon here, and you'll hear from him right here in a few weeks. So, ladies and gentlemen, that'll do it for The Healthy Mind this week. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. I really do appreciate it. As always, the website, www.thehealthymind.com. Any questions, comments, anything, I want to hear from you. Don't hesitate to be in touch with me. The email address, as always, peter@thehealthymind.com. That's peter@thehealthymind.com. And for the Healthy Mind Podcast, part of the Healthy Mind Network, I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis. Have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next time right here on the Healthy Mind.